So welcome to Wednesday of Meta-Analysis Week. Today what we're going to focus on is the second really important step, the third really important step, which is being able to look at a piece of results and turn it into an effect size for your database. The first big decision is what studies you're going to put into your meta-analysis. And the best suggestion I have for you is everything that you can find. Start reading meta-analyses and read where people tell you they found their stuff. Because there's sort of an underground of where things are hidden. One of the greatest examples, I think, ever of somebody who was always able to find a data set to test the hypothesis he cared about is in the book called Freakonomics. I don't know how he tracked down some of those databases, but he was amazing at finding a data set. I know somebody who went to a couple of his talks, and he said that he's got an underground of thousands of people, and he basically sends out an email and says, does anybody know where something like this is? And meta-analysts have said that they have similar sort of networks that they feed off of each other. And so if you stay in that sort of research, you're likely to build up membership in a research community like in other communities where you know stuff because your community trains you up. But a really good place to start is where other people have said they have found things. The second big step, of course, is to decide what information you're going to code, keep, and analyze for each study or each meta-analysis. And the idea is there, anything that you think may be causing effect size differences across studies. Now we're going to start talking about some of the theories and the logic behind why effect sizes vary across studies when we look at the actual meta-analysis on Friday. We're going to see that there's two basic notions. One is the notion, which has sort of fallen off the table, that studies ought to replicate each other because they're basically the same study being repeated. And within that notion, the difference between effect sizes of replications is error. There's no good reason that different studies find different effects. Then there's the more realistic, that studies probably aren't really good replications of each other, and there are reasons. Now, we've played the same game ourselves. When we talk about who we're going to sample into a regular piece of research where we have a population that we're trying to represent, we get a whole bunch of people, and we don't expect those people to all have the same score because people are different. In fact, the primary game that we play is how do we sort them into groups that are different or how do we line them up on continua that are different? ANOVA type stats and correlation type stats. Because we believe that not only are people different from each other, but they are reasonably, lawfully, predictably different from each other. And then all of behavioral sciences is an argument about what variables you should pay attention to capture differences between people. It's not going to be any simpler in meta-analysis. By the time you go through and make all the decisions that have to be made to create, complete, and analyze a data set, the results of that data set is probably near as complicated as an organism. And so we shouldn't expect that this is going to be simple. Just like none of you collect data across the entire spectrum of social psychology, you're probably not going to be able to collect data across the whole spectrum of how studies differ from each other. Different people focus on different things. I spent years doing meta-analyses with people, the whole idea of which was to try and understand why effect sizes from non-experiments and quasi-experiments were routinely larger than from true experiments. That isn't what we were taught. A true experiment has control. You've got random assignment, you've got manipulation, you've got control, you've got less error, you've got multivariate statistics that control the error further. Why the hell are non-experiments routinely giving you stronger effects than experiments? Do you know? Yeah, you do. Let's look at it. If I have an independent variable, I randomly assign and manipulate who's in what's condition. This is a true independent variable. This is a foot stomper. This is a true independent variable. It's not related to anything. So, how many causal agents are operating in this study?
One.
Now, let's say that this is a grouping variable. Say it's whether or not you came to a review session. We can randomly assign and manipulate that and run a true experiment. Done it a million times. Or we can say, before you take the test, who came to the review session? Just mark it on the top. When you type your name in, tell me whether or not you went to the review session. Now I've got a grouping variable. Is that an IV? Is that an IV in the independent variable sense of the word? No. It's deeply dependent upon a whole bunch of things that are likely to all be related to exam performance. In a true experiment, I've got one causal agent. In a non-experiment, I've got God only knows how many, and they are pushing typically in the same direction to a different extent depending upon how correlated they are with each other. Because if you start collecting a lot of other variables, you discover that the people who show up for the review session tend to have done more homework, tend to spend more time on this or that, blah, 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 all of which are causal agents that are driving the outcome. You with me? Now, once you say that, it's like, well, no shit. But proving that to the education community was 10 hard years, a lot of which were meta-analyses. I wasn't looking at all the cool things that described the samples. I was just looking at the cool things that described what led up to taking the test. I missed all kinds of stuff that I know is important for predicting a test score. But at the time, I was studying a thing. So once again, what we see is a really important parallel between empirical research and meta-analytic research. You got to start with a population. You've got to have a sampling frame that you can defend. You got to pick the variables that you can defend that are going to be rich enough to give you a story that's nearly as complicated as the phenomena you're trying to study. This is one of the reasons for looking seriously at meta-analysis, because it reminds us the nightmare we've gotten ourselves into. Because in order to do the study of individual differences or group differences well, we have to study methodology to do that research. It's not enough to know, hey, I know between and within groups design. Sure, which one are you going to use? One of them. How are you going to choose? One of them. To be researchers, we have to become methodologists. Seriously. Most of you won't have a career that allows you to spend your time rolling around in the methodologies of 30 different research areas. You're going to have to first learn what your kind, what your people expect. But then you got to pay enough attention, largely through collaborations, taking courses in different departments when you're still a graduate student, so that you can push the boundaries of your people and bring in things that might add to it. But don't think you're done with methodology when you're done with the methodology courses. The very best researchers are constantly improving what they know about methodology. Meta-analysis, done properly, is a great way to get a handle on all the different ways that people are doing things. When you start coding those variables, you are going to notice shit that you didn't notice when you read the title, the abstract, and the first and last three paragraphs, which is all you need to get that paper into your term paper. Then it comes down to cranking out effect sizes, and that's what we're going to focus on today. The actual meta-analysis itself is pretty easy. even if you do simple versions on Excel, which is what we're going to focus on Friday, certainly if you're using big expensive statistical packages, it's no harder than any other statistical package. You got a database, you say put these variables into the model, and it does. It's the buildup that's the big deal. And for reasons that I don't completely understand, people get all whiny about the buildup and the subjectivity of the meta-analysis in ways that they don't get whiny and concerned about the buildup and subjectivity of every empirical study ever done. Recognize that you are living in a land of subjectivity. Not only is it subjective, but it is a victim of fads and fashions. I can't tell you how many things in teaching have been sort of set down and aren't done anymore. Not because anybody showed they don't work, just because we moved on to something cooler. And the next half generation wasn't taught that these five things that rocked 10 years ago still rock. So one of the hardest things to do when you're young is to separate the reasons to study things. One of the best things you can do, this is career advice from an old guy. Look at the classic phenomena in a new way. Because those classic phenomena aren't solved. And the new way is a new tool. I don't know how many of you have yards. I have a yard and I like yard tools. I love yard tools. I have yard tools that I don't need to have. Just to fuck with them. For years, I did not have a trimmer. You know that little thing that cuts along the sidewalk? It makes really I did it with this and that and something else. I just didn't like them because I didn't want another small engine that I had to maintain. And I hate cords. Well, now we have battery driven. And I went out and bought one of these things that happens to use the same battery as my father-in-law's chainsaw. We were pretty clever about this. Because who uses a chainsaw and a trimmer at the same time, right? Now that I have a trimmer, I can't believe I lived without one. And that's the way you're going to feel about learning new methodologies and new statistics. You've got to commit yourself to learning more shit than you know when you graduate. And I'm telling you, meta-analysis will drag you into the future. Every time you do a meta-analysis, you're going to see choices, samplings, techniques, software, theories that you hadn't run across before. Everything's in the literature, but we don't read the literature the way we should. We read the abstract, the title, and the first and last four paragraphs. Sometimes we'll go look at the method section to see who the population is. But there's more in there, and especially when you're little. You got to build that up as fast as you can. And so a meta-analysis is one of the best ways I know to know more about the literature than everybody you're in the room with. Remember, that's our goal, to be the one in the room. All right, so let's look at effect sizes. That's my official cheerleader effort for the day. The first time I heard that, Gene Glass had about six beers in him, and he made me look uninterested. This is somebody who just spent 5 years dropping something on the planet that he wasn't sure if they were going to tolerate it or not, and he was getting great feedback. So he was a little enthusiastic. All right, effect sizes. We're going to use capital ES to mean whatever sort of effect size we meet at the time. The reason that that is used is because once you calculate the effect size, the way you operate on them, doesn't really care what kind of effect size it is. So you're going to pick a kind of effect size and calculate it. Then when you have them all the rest of it just says ES. So we got four kinds of ESs and then interpreting, transforming, adjusting, right? Because the processes you apply to them really don't care which one it is, for the most part. So let's take a tour. The tour has two intents, to expose you to them and give you an idea of how to calculate them. The computator has lots and lots of different ways of getting to an effect size, more than you've probably paid attention to. more than is really fun to sort out. And so, because I love you, I made you this. This is examples of the 10 most common things you start with, what you use in the computator to calculate D's, and what you use in the calculator to calculate R's. Your homework is basically supported by this. I don't expect you to have all this stuff in your head, but I do expect to pick up a handout and go digging through and find the one that matches and go from there. There's one of these. There's one of these that may be a problem, and I'll tell you about that. We have some root rot. Somebody has taken something off of their web page, but I'll bet you I can beg us another version. So, kinds of effect sizes. The D, the standardized mean difference, is the one you're most likely to see given where y'all are from. It's particularly used in education. The D is basically a Z value. What it does is it represents the difference between two groups in terms of the standard deviation. So how big is the mean difference in standard deviation terms? We'll look at it more. It was built for between groups designs. Within groups designs are a pain in the tuchus because there's two different logics to use to calculate effect sizes from a within groups design. And I'm going to tell you this, and we're going to go over it carefully, because part of our problem, your problem, not mine, part of your problem is going to be that very often people have been trained in one of these or the other and don't know that there's two. And so you're going to have to make a decision, sometimes deciding whether to match something or do what you think is best. But you might have to ask, so what the hell did you do? And they'll look at you like, I ran a standardized gain score. How? What do you mean how? You have to get it out of them as politely as you can. The one that I tend to use most often, and the one we're going to emphasize in here, is correlation. Same way we emphasize that when we were talking about effect sizes in units 2 and 3. The reason is you can put more different things into an R. If you have a two-group design, you can make a D. Two-group design that you use a t-test or an ANOVA on, you can do a D or an R. If you have a two-group design that you use a chi-square, the D doesn't make sense. If you have any form of correlation, a D doesn't make sense. And so the R is the more generalizable if you want to include analyses that use different analytic techniques. So if you want to get ANOVAs and between ANOVAs and correlations and chi-squares and a whole bunch of other stuff we'll talk about all in one pile, R is the one that's going to work best for you on that. Odds ratios are for binary dependent variables. Odds ratios work better than chi-squares converted to R's. The farther you move from a 50-50 split, the more an odds ratio is likely to be more representative than an R and a chi-square. Also, odds ratios make sense. If you do this, you're three times as likely to be successful as if you did that. That's an effect size I can identify with. I don't have to think about small, medium, and large. I don't have to think about conversion error and bias. I just, three times as likely, fuck, sign me up. And don't forget that we can do meta-analyses on univariate statistics, means or proportions. We might want to take every study we can find published in APA for a two-year period and ask, what is the relative proportion of different ethnic groups represented in that literature? The relative proportion of different orientation groups represented in that literature? So I don't care why they ran the study. I'm looking up everybody's method section in the participants, and that's all I'm pulling out of every study. And at the end of that, we offer APA a review of how well their attempt to improve population sampling has worked over a 3-year period. Make sense? The typical reason for doing univariate prevalence studies is to establish population parameter estimates. Because we want to know, how many of these do we tend to have? How many of those do we tend to have? How many of us? How many of them? You can guess at it, you can make shit up, or you can do a meta-analysis. The definition of a useful effect size is that it's standardized. I give you published results, and you can crank out an effect size, and we all get pretty much the same number. That's what I mean by standardized. There is a standard formula and logic, and if I give you all the same results, you all get the same answer in your effect sizes, just like homework. And we have to be able to estimate a standard error. Whenever we calculate an estimate, we have to have some way of calculating by how much that estimate is likely to be in error. That's a standard error. Because when you put an effect size over a standard error of the effect size, you now have a summary statistic, you can get a p-value, and you can decide whether that aggregated effect size is different from zero or different from any other value that you want to test. So standardized mean difference, a z-like summary statistic that tells the size of the difference between the means of the two groups. It expresses the mean difference in standard deviation terms. So a d of 1 tells us that the treatment mean is 1 standard deviation bigger than the control mean. This is awesome when different people use different versions of the same variable. For example, we're doing a study on, I think it was double-digit subtraction. Whole meta-analysis on different techniques for teaching double-digit subtraction. And there were different numbers of items on different tests. And some tests were intended to be easier and some tests were intended to be harder. And so number correct was unmanageable. Even percent correct was unmanageable because some of these tests are designed to be differentially difficult. But if we crank everything into z-scores, d-values, now I've got that one number, and that tells me how different the groups are in something that is pretty much standardized, and I can calculate an error term. When Cohen was Harper, apparently, there you are, sitting, thinking you're having breakfast in Harper and Harper Dining Hall, and then you're thrown out into the streets because there's gas. Fortunately, it's a nice warm day. When Cohen was working with Dee, he said, based on a review of the applied social psych literature, that's what he was focusing on, 0.2, 0.5, 0.8. So a medium-sized effect is half a standard deviation. Like our 1-3-5 for correlation, it's not standard across all research areas. You got to know how big of an effect is considered how important in your research area by your people. These are the most common formulas for it. It starts out reasonably enough. What's the difference between the means? And then taking into account the variability. That S is a standard deviation of the difference between two means, a standard error. There's a wide variety of D-like effect sizes, not R or equivalent. Some are intended as sample descriptions, while others are intended as population estimates. Define and use the different ends carefully. Make sure you know what's going on. Compute the variability of the mean difference differently and correct for various potential biases. Before the meta, and okay, so the effect size people got into it before the meta-analysis people had a strong foothold. So we're calculating effect sizes. And we want a really good calculation. Because remember, this is post-Sputnik. This is during the time where we dare not waste any study. We're in a big hurry, which showed up in academics as publish or perish, which isn't really publish or perish. It was get something out of every expensive data set. That's what drove Publisher Parish. And so, if we're not going to replicate the way we know we should, we need each effect size calculated from each data set to be as good as possible. And they're off, trying to figure out how to take a D and give you a better version of D that corrects for measurement bias, inter-rater reliability bias, blah, 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 any frickin' thing you can name that might have gone into it. And it's probably not a lie to say hundreds of them, especially if you go outside American and British psychology, because we have junior amateur mathematicians all through social sciences. Somebody'd work up a new one, they'd publish with it. Somebody in their research area grabbed it and published with it. When the meta-analysts came along, they said, folks, fucking quit. Quit correcting for different combinations of things with different qualities of corrections. Just publish the information we need to calculate a basic effect size, and we'll clean up all the rest of that stuff in the meta-analysis instead of the effect size estimate. So that's one reason that we're not looking at the whole big panoply of all these different deltas, gammas, gamma D, gamma delta, delta gamma. It's like going down fraternity row. What we're going to focus on is the ones that are going to give you a good estimate of that effect size, and then we'll talk about how to clean things up for corrections and debiasing as we go. The cool thing about working with this is that several people have come up with shortcuts. The pooled standard deviation is the square root of the mean square error. Sometimes you don't have. They don't give you a mean square error. But if they give you the means and the ends, you can use the means and the ends to calculate a mean square between. F is mean square between divided by mean square within. If you have any two, you can solve for the third. So if you have the F and you have the mean square between, you can solve for the term you need to calculate it. That formula has saved my ass more than I can tell you. Because until the middle 80s, people did not routinely publish standard deviations for each group. They did not routinely publish standard errors and error terms. You had to go find a way. This worked. This is one of the first pieces of programming I ever did. My Commodore 64 calculated this for me. You can also start directly from a T or from an F. Now, these are the links that are dead right now. I have to figure out a substitute for them. They're really useful because I need a T or an F. Very often, they don't give us a T or an F. The situation where they don't give us a T or an F that's most annoying is in pairwise comparisons in most statistical packages. They give you the mean difference, they give you the standard error of the mean difference, and then they give you a p-value. But if I have the p-value and I have the degrees of freedom, I can plug it into one of these and get the T or the F that I need to work from there. What we're trying to do is create a system within which, if you can bring me a summary statistic or a p-value, I can get you an effect size. And that's why there's so many different versions. There's just so many different places to start based on what someone felt like publishing.